I'm speaking with Dirk van der Valle, who is professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He is the author of A History of Modern Libya and Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dirk van der Valle.
Thank you.
And clearly, this is turning into a monstrous situation in Libya with the Gaddafi clan determined to hold on to the last bullet, as his son said the other day. And apparently African mercenaries are streaming in from the south. What's your sense of how much blood will have to be shed before either he ends up like Ceausescu or he ends up on a plane like the Tunisian kleptocrats?
Well, I think there is probably a high probability of an enormous amount more bloodshed in Libya. First of all, as you just said, the regime itself has very clearly indicated, both Gaddafi and his son, that this is really a fight to the end, and that has been kind of the older Gaddafi's philosophy all along. And of course, it gets exacerbated because, in a sense, the cycle of violence that is taking place in Libya is really heightened by the fact that neither side at this particular point has anything to lose. By that I mean that if the rebels or the insurgency loses, then the repercussions will be incredibly bloody. On the other hand, if these mercenaries who are throwing their lot in with the Gaddafi regime lose, it will be the same thing. So in a sense, there's a cycle of violence here, a mechanism that is really way out of proportion, extraordinary, and in a sense does not really allow for the kind of compromise that has taken place, for example, in Egypt and in Tunisia. And one of the big issues, of course, is that as opposed to Egypt and Tunisia, there really is no group that can function as an intermediary in Libya between the two factions. Gaddafi has deliberately, for 40 years, in a very extensive divide-and-rule fashion, made sure that no one could ever really rise up against his regime, against his authority. So, in a sense, it's this division that exists within the country that, again, also fuels this dynamic of a conflict that I thought originally would be over rather quickly, but seems to be able to kind of keep itself going, helped, of course, by these mercenaries for a much longer time than I would have thought possible.
Well, Kirk van der Valle, we're learning now from what happened in Benghazi, since it's largely occupied by the opposition and some journalists have come in, the ruthlessness of this regime, where the people stormed a military base and anti-aircraft weapons were used to mow down demonstrators and causing enormous carnage. It certainly says two things, that Gaddafi will stop at nothing, and two, that the people who are rising up against this dictator are incredibly courageous.
Oh, yes. Well, the first thing, of course, as we just discussed, we knew that for Gaddafi, this truly is not just a matter of life or death. It is also, for him, really an opportunity, in a sense, to be seen, as he himself said, as a martyr. And this kind of complex really goes back a long, long ways. It really goes back to Omar al-Mukhtar, the hero, the national hero of Libya, who was hanged by the Italians in 1932, after leading the Libyan defense against the Italian invasion. And Gaddafi really sees himself very much in that same role. As somebody, he keeps referring, also the son kept referring in his speech on Sunday, to, look, if you don't rally around the flag, essentially what will happen is that we're going to have the Americans come in, we're going to see Islamists come in, and eventually there's going to be civil war. And so, the alternatives to him are clear. And so he sees himself really I think, at least in his own mind, as a person that is holding back any kind of element that could destroy the Libyan nation, whatever Libyan nation that is, because that itself is a very suspect concept, of course, after what Gaddafi has done for the last 40 years.
But surely, Dirk van der Valle, this is all rather convenient fiction on Gaddafi's part, in as much as using the foreign bogeyman. I mean, It's true that Ronald Reagan dropped some bombs on him some time back, but it's also true that since the Lockerbie deal was made, the U.S. and other Western powers have moved in and improved his oil exports, and clearly that was his thinking. He got tired of the sanctions, and it was a kind of win-win for both sides, even though it was obviously ultimately a very shabby deal. And I take it that whole deal is going to be exposed now, because the justice minister, who has defected, went on Swedish television and said he's going to spill the beans about Gaddafi being the one that ordered the bombing of the Pan Am 747.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, if indeed the regime gets overthrown, whenever it happens, that we'll see lots and lots of dirty laundry, coming out of Libya, and the regime's involvement in many, not just the Lockerbie, perhaps the Lockerbie bombing, but also many of the other still unexplained terrorist incidents that have taken place over the years. It was a highly secretive regime, and so we should expect to learn a lot more, as the archives, so to speak, are opened up in the next few weeks and months, hopefully.
But do you feel that that it's all rather kind of belated, our recognition of how hideous this fellow was? I mean, how much do you think the West is complicit in sort of turning a blind eye and, by extension, more or less giving this guy a free pass?
Well, I think there was a certain amount of complicity, and certainly, for example, just to give one example, the freeing of Mizrahi and so on, was certainly, I think, personally, done in part for economic interests on the British. So there are all these kinds of incidents where, indeed, to some extent, I think the West was complicit, and certainly the United States in the latter years turned a kind of a blind eye also, not really criticizing the regime too much occasionally, but in a sense not very forcefully, in part because, of course, irony of ironies, the man that was once in our eyes the greatest terrorist on earth suddenly became our partner in a crime trying to prevent terrorism in North Africa. So there certainly was a bit of hypocrisy on the side of the West as well.
And Kurt van der Veller, again, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He's the author of The History of Modern Libya and Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building. Clearly, oil has been in large part the reason why the U.S. and the Western powers are in there, and it's also been obviously created this massive sovereign fund, and over the decades, four decades, Gaddafi has squandered an enormous amount of money, but it still keeps flowing, and the fact of the matter is now the global price of oil has gone up because of the uncertainty. There was a hint in Saif al-Assam's, the son's, rather kind of thug-like broadcast that he made the other day, and he's supposed to be Western educated, and a lot of American academics helped him on his books about democracy in the third world, etc. Made some allusion maybe to sort of Saddam Hussein's tactic of burning the oil fields. Do you think there is that kind of Gotterdammerung possibility here, or the Samson syndrome, as it's often called, bringing the whole thing down?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. Certainly, that would perhaps be one of the scenarios, and so obviously one of the scare tactics that you're absolutely right was in that rather surreal speech that Saif al-Islam gave. But I think particularly we should remember that Libya is still very much a tribal society, and that the tribal territories really overlap in part these oil areas. And I think all tribes, no matter what, and I would suspect there could be some trouble between different tribes, but I think if there's one thing that everyone realizes within the tribe system, within the tribal system, is that you need to preserve that infrastructure to bring oil to the coast, because that's the only lifeline for the country, and it is a lifeline that, incidentally, is shared, you know, both by Tripolitania and Cyrenaica. So unless the regime itself sends out some mercenaries or operatives to set those fields on fire, my hunch would be that rather than go into that kind of action, a lot of the local tribes and a lot of the local crews would actually be pretty protective of those fields. So, you know, Saddam Hussein, in a sense, was a scorched earth policy because he didn't care anymore as the Americans were coming in what happened. But the people around him, in a sense, really couldn't do much about his action. I think in Libya, it's a little bit different. And I would venture that we're not going to see the kind of burning of oil fields that we've seen, when Iraq withdrew.
So I guess nobody knows, and Dirk van der Velde, since you're a specialist on Libya, I take it you're not going to get into the prediction business about how much longer this agony will go on, because there are estimates of 1,000 dead. It's got to be much more than 1,000. And if it's these reports that are coming in today that thousands of African mercenary and militiamen who are apparently being paid, I heard, up to $1,000 a day. I don't know what figures they're being paid, but they're streaming in. It looks like this battle could go on for weeks.
Yes, indeed. And I must say, frankly, even as somebody who has observed the country quite closely for 25 years, there were lots and lots of surprises here. The appearance of mercenaries was surprises. The fact that the uprising in the eastern part of the country was successful and sustained was very surprising. The fact that Gaddafi himself is still in Tripoli and hasn't been displaced is also very surprising. So there are lots of things here that are very, very unique. The fact also that it truly is a popular uprising. There was no kind of organized interest. There was no organization to it at all. And, you know, it's ironic in the light of what Gaddafi always says, you know, give power to the people. Well, you know, the people have taken power, in a sense, in Libya. And, you know, Gaddafi may be at the wrong end of the deal regarding this.
Well, but that was that was textbook despotism, wasn't it? You know, his green book and living in a tent. In retrospect, that's just ridiculous theater. This guy was an absolute autocrat who was reserving almost all of the pie for him and his family, and the rest of the country was getting the crumbs. I mean, this is an oil-rich country with what, 30% unemployment?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, obviously a lot of this was pure window dressing and nothing else. But of course, in a state and a dictatorship as tightly controlled as Libya, no one really can tell the emperor that he has no clothes. And a lot of the people that we're now starting to see to turn against him, of course, were people also in high positions who didn't say anything at the time either. Now, you know, some of that I think is perfectly understandable. The regime was so vicious, in a sense, that even if an individual within a family went into the opposition or so, you could see your entire family targeted. So people were extremely careful. But we'll see much more of this. And, of course, the hypocrisy and the kind of use of language to keep himself and his family in power was overwhelming. But, you know, in a sense, we're now starting to see, hopefully, the end to that. And certainly the Green Book and other writings were, in a sense, only justification and certainly nothing more than ideological ramblings of a man who, in a sense, really had lost touch with reality, you know, with the reality around him.
And he's surrounded by this inner core of female bodyguards, who I understand the North Koreans and the East Germans trained at various times. Is that that's, I suppose, that's window dressing too, right?
oh, absolutely. I mean, the Amazons, as they're called, is pure window dressing, you know, allegedly to protect the the leader himself, Gaddafi. But I can tell you from personal experience that I've seen in plenty of occasions where you know, the real security forces that accompany Gaddafi will kind of summarily push these women out of the way if they in any way think, you know, that there's a security issue. So yes, you're absolutely right. Pure window dressing.
Well, presumably they had other uses apart from toting guns, right? I mean, he did think of himself as God's gift to women. At least that's based upon some female reporters I've spoken to who have interviewed him.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Actually, I believe that. I think that I know the reporters you're referring to, and I would not really believe that. There's no evidence of that whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned.
So that's just tabloid territory, right?
Exactly.
I see. Well, let's get back to serious discussion here, Dirk van der Wille. Not that we can in any way be lighthearted about what's happening, because it's deeply tragic. But as you mentioned earlier, this is a dictator who did not who weakened all the institutions around him, including the military, to preserve power. And there will be an enormous vacuum to fill when eventually Gaddafi's and his clan are driven out. What do you think? I mean, first of all, is there any possibility of, for example, the Egyptian army or somebody intervening to stop the bloodshed, or is that just a given that the bloodletting will continue?
I think that the neighboring countries, but particularly Egypt, would be very loath to go into Libya. Relations between the two countries have never been very warm. And I think most, even most Egyptian military people would realize that Libya could very well turn out to be a real quagmire. So I don't really see intervention from the immediate neighbors. As a matter of fact, I think what we've seen so far, from what I understand, is that both the Egyptians and the Tunisians have beefed up security on their sides of the border, obviously, you know, worried about massive outflows of people from Libya. The other intervention, of course, could come from the international community, and allegedly, you know, there is a stipulation under the U8 mandate that says that in cases of genocide and so on, the international community can intervene. Whether or not that will be used, I think perhaps not. There usually is kind of an inclination of even in these kind of very severe cases of kind of stepping on the toes of a sovereign country, so to speak. But my hunch is that now that the American diplomats have just about all left the country, we'll probably see some increase in the language coming out of Washington, and perhaps Washington starting to take some initiative to put a halt to this. But again, this is a very difficult situation, and particularly if you have paid mercenaries and troops loyal to Gaddafi, you know, for any group to come in, I think would be very difficult and very dangerous. And I'm not sure that you could convince a lot of people, even under UN mandate, to do that type of operation.
And the UN is not that nimble, neither, are they? I mean, they don't have a ready reaction force. There's been calls for that over the years, and it would probably come down to the U.S., and I imagine Obama probably doesn't necessarily think that's such a great idea. And as you pointed out, it could really backfire. So just to sort of figure out the end game here, you don't think that the oil's going to be interrupted and that whatever successor government...
Yeah, I'm not sure that the oil won't be interrupted. I mean, you know, there certainly could be, you know, some short-term interruptions, and even that, as you said in your introduction, you know, can have major impacts on the kind of the spiking of the price of oil. We've already seen that. So, you know, there may be some interruption as, you know, some of these battles continue, and as the country if there is indeed a post-Gaddafi era, you know, trying to reestablish kind of order again, kind of going back to what you just said a minute ago, you know, when faced with this enormous vacuum in which there are no administrative, bureaucratic, or serious professional organizations, you know, this is going to be an enormous mess. And so I would expect some disturbances that they had. But I certainly wouldn't expect the kind of apocalyptic scenario that you pointed of, you know, the Gaddafis setting the fields on fire, or real long-term disturbances. Again, I think both provinces and the tribes within the provinces realize that they have to maintain access to oil and make sure that that oil gets to the coast.
But just in closing, Dirk van der Velde, the exiles in London don't seem to have much traction within the country, and it would seem that the Islamists, supposedly stronger in the East, would be checked, I suppose, to some extent by some of the tribal arrangements. So it's really, I think, impossible to figure out who'd be in charge, right?
Oh yeah, it's extreme. I mean, this is an extremely fluid situation. In regard to the Islamist movements, I mean, certainly, you know, Libya has had Islamist movements, and they've repressed them quite heavily in the 1990s. But I think, much like in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood, in the West, for our own reasons, I think we tend to exaggerate what the impact of these movements could be. I simply cannot see a development in Libya where one of these radical movements would actually take over. You know, Libyans are I think, much more in tune with what is going on, and certainly I don't think they would look very favorably upon a group that comes in and establishes a new dictatorship, not under a secular authority, but under a religious authority this time.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here this evening in Los Angeles, Dirk van der Velde. I know you've been incredibly busy, and I guess it's one of those moments where we're both grateful that we have experts on Libya, and it couldn't happen at a worse time, I suppose, in order to bring this subject to the fore.
Yes, well, it was my pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking with Dirk van der Velde, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He is the author of A History of Modern Libya and Libya Since Independence, Oil and State Building.